there is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, that's what that movie's, what, 40 years old? True then, true today. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. You know, I look at, last week we talked a little bit about net neutrality and what it would mean. And we had Tim Carr on the program from Free Press, you know, saying this could be the, you know, the end of the free and open internet. Programs like mine would just be devastated. Any opportunity to organize, I think, would also be harmed. But I saw this piece over at, The Guardian, it was the Globe and Mail that said, look, if net neutrality goes through, it would be the death knell for the resistance. So I've asked Sarah Kendzior, the author of that great piece, to come talk with us and explain what exactly she means by, well, the end. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So is this being hyperbolic? I mean, come on, it's the end? It's the death knell of the resistance, really?
Well, it's not net neutrality in isolation. I think if this policy had been passed under any other administration, it would be a bad and dangerous policy, but you have to look at it in the context of the administration and its goals. In the article, I talk about net neutrality, but also about things like the packing of the courts, with lifetime unqualified ultra-conservative nominees, and also, you know, election integrity and the lack thereof for the 2018 midterm. So if we don't like these policies, our ability to, get the people who enacted them out of office is going to be greatly constrained. And so when you combine all these things together, you end up with restrictions on free speech, a lack of, you know, free-flowing information, inability to organize, inability to vote, you know, mass disenfranchisement, inability to take your concerns to the courts to try to get a legal, solution, you know, when these situations arise. Like, it's an entirely rigged system, like a web of interconnected problems. And so that's what I'm concerned about, and net neutrality is just one part of that.
Yeah, it's the whole thing, but net, as you point out, net neutrality is just a part of it. But for people who don't know what net neutrality is, because most of us have lives, what exactly are we talking about?
I mean, basically, it's sort of what we take for granted about the internet, that you'll be able to go on, that no corporation or provider can determine which websites you can access, how slowly they'll load, what kind of information you can get, and that it's all sort of, you know, widely available. You don't pick like a package which lists, a few dozen sites or something and then pay for that. You just pay for access to the internet, and then whatever, is on the internet is something that you can potentially reach. And if you get rid of that, it can go in a variety of ways, but the key thing is that, you know, corporations will have the ability to decide what kind of content you can access, how much it would cost, and that's an important thing, because part of this is simply that people will be priced out of getting access to the sites and the programs they want. Like, if somebody wants to pay, to make sure they get, Amazon, they will pay for that and possibly give up getting access to, other news sites in the process. And for independent, low-budget places, which is your own program, this poses a lot of problems because, for me too, as somebody who works primarily as a freelancer, like, we rely on, having access ourselves to all sorts of information, but also, on our audience. We rely on people being able to reach us. And if they can't reach us, then it's very difficult to earn a living and to keep our programs going, and also just to exchange information with our audience.
Yeah.
That's frightening to me. I think that we've gotten to the point where internet and, online media has supplanted print media. We have a dying print media. And so if we lose a free online media and forms of communication, we're really left in the lurch. We're going to, you know, I don't know, I guess figure out a way to work around it. I'm sure people are coming up with ways to work around it now, but it'll make everything exponentially harder as we try to contest this administration.
Yeah, I've had a couple of conservatives give me alternate arguments, you know, one being that this is the ultimate free market, that, you know, the power of the dollar, Sarah, that people will get the content that they want, that they're willing to pay for, and this will be better for everybody. That even the guy even actually made an argument that if people wanted my program badly enough, that they would pay for it and I would be better off because of it.
They can't. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I'm sure plenty of people would want to. I'm sure plenty of people would want to subscribe to a number of publications and support a lot of authors. But, you know, this economy is not good. People don't have this kind of disposable income. And the other thing is, you know, especially if you're, you know, under, I don't know, 30 or 40 years old, you're accustomed to getting this content for free. And it feels like something, you know, you don't want to pay for. You know, I know people who are very reluctant to pay the subscription fees for, you know, like the New York Times or Washington Post, although I would not recommend subscribing to New York Times right now, but that's another story. But, you know, we all know the ways around it. We know how to open, like, the incognito window so that we just don't have to pay, like, you know, 10 cents or whatever the hell it is that they're doing. But I really think it's unlikely that all this money is going to come pouring out from people, especially for folks like us who cover social issues, who cover, marginalized communities and people who are disadvantaged. Like, that's often our audience. And if I'm covering poverty, like, people do not have the money to support my work. You know, the people that may be most interested in it just don't. And I don't want to, you know, have people in that position. I think it's really much more likely that a lot of the media will just simply die out. And I think that that's what the Trump administration wants, because they want alternative facts. They don't want people to have the ability to debate and discuss and organize and put out their own independent platforms.
No, I'm right there with you. And look, I would love, you know, more people to subscribe to our program. But at the end of the day, I'm not begging poor people for money. We should be organizing to fight back against this stuff. But here's the other argument. And I wanted to get your thought on this, because, you know, there's all of this talk around Russia. There's all of this talk about meddling. There's all of this talk about fake news. And we see a lot of craziness coming out of, you know, places like Breitbart. The argument made by a conservative friend of mine is saying we're just not capable as citizens, as a society, to handle this powerful tool. We need someone to supervise it.
No, well, we don't need these people to supervise. We don't need the Trump administration to supervise. We don't need corporations or the FCC to supervise. Like, what we need to do is work on, you know, critical thinking and independent thought and research. And the best way to do that is to have, information accessible to us, I agree that, you know, technology has moved very fast and that our politics haven't been able to keep pace with it. But the problem with that is a human flaw. Like, we are at fault, you know, as a society for not handling this issue better. And I don't think there's some sort of corporate overlord who's going to make this go away. What you're much more likely to have is what you have in a number of countries is a sort of propaganda ministry. I think in our case, we'll get an Americanized version of it, which will mean it's, you know, corporate. It's often determined by how much income you have. You know, that'll determine how much information you're allowed to receive. It'll have to do with the politics of whoever it is that's making those sorts of decisions. And, you know, even if they see themselves as apolitical, any kind of situation that involves determining people's access to news and information becomes a political problem. And I don't think there's anyone qualified to say, you know, this is what you can see. This is what's worth seeing. This is how much something is worth. This is how, you know, quickly or slowly something will load for you. Like, that's a lot of power. And I don't think it's really right for, you know, just a few people or, you know, a few companies to have that kind of power.
Yeah. And in your article, you're right. The erosion of freedom of speech and assembly has always been a hallmark of dictatorship, one traditionally associated with formal decrees of censorship or dramatic acts like book burning. In Mr. Trump's corporatized administration, overt state censorship is unnecessary and undesirable. And I agree. And is this that first step towards, you know, maybe an American-type dictatorship with all of the assaults and attack on the media?
Yeah, I worry that it is. I mean, I don't think it's the first step because they've tried, you know, a number of things that have been autocratic in nature. You know, the attacks on immigrants, for example, and, you know, there are many examples throughout the year. But this is one that could actually succeed. And, you know, I think people look for signs that we're becoming a fascist or an autocratic society, and they look for these sort of outward things like Trump has censored the news. And, you know, what's been more likely to happen, you know, is, as I said, the manipulation of technology by corporations that just limit your access, and also things that like excessive litigation, like what Peter Thiel did to Gawker last year. You know, I think that a lot of companies may be sued out of existence. I think as revenue declines as a result of net neutrality being repealed and independent companies are struggling to keep afloat, that will make them even more ripe targets for litigation. And so I do see this, you know, as a serious problem. And because, you know, the greatest weapon I think we have, you know, for those of us who want a democracy and who are opposing what Trump is doing, is our ability to communicate with each other and to debunk lies and propaganda and to, you know, put out our own ideas and use our freedom of speech and, you know, our ability to organize protests and whatnot. That will be, you know, decimated, not totally, but enough that what's already, you know, a very serious problem will become, you know, more, I don't want to say insurmountable, but just extremely difficult to resolve. It'll hurt us very badly. And they know that. And I think that's one of the reasons that they're trying to go ahead with it.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, to kind of put your whole argument into place, the net neutrality kind of taking some of the message away, lawsuits, you know, going after, you know, places that maybe dissent, and then having a court system packed with crazy right wingers. This is like the hat trick of horrible.
Yeah, I mean, there's no accountability. You know, there's just judgment. There's predetermined judgment, which is exactly the kind of thing you see in an authoritarian state, where there's no recourse for people who want to preserve these freedoms, and there's no recourse for people who want to challenge dictates that are anti-democratic that may be passed. And so that's extremely concerning, you know, and I've worried that they would try to pass something like this before the 2018 midterms because, you know, those midterms offer a potential opportunity for, you know, the makeup of the House to change, of the Senate to change, and, you know, perhaps for the Democrats to get enough of a majority that impeachment proceedings will begin. And, you know, I kept thinking they're going to do everything they can to try to stave off that outcome. And I think what we're seeing now is an acceleration as we get towards the end of 2017, you know, and we're less than a year from those elections.
So, you know, I mean, and looking at just the attack on media and the attack on just messaging, I look at Donald Trump tweeted out this morning, at Fox News is much more important in the United States than CNN, but outside the U.S., CNN International is still a major source of fake news, and they represent our nation to the world very poorly. To the outside world does not see the truth from there. And then later this afternoon, what you saw is the tweet going around. Egypt MFA spokesman tweeted out, as usual, deplorable CNN coverage of Sinai tragedy today. You know, anchors more interested in reporters' access to Sinai than to those who lost their lives. So, you know, this Trump effect of, you know, global attack on media just seems to be getting more powerful.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, and I think that's the best way to look at it in terms of something like CNN International. That attack, that tweet, wasn't really made for domestic consumption. You know, it also mirrored, you know, things that Putin has said about, you know, the presence of CNN and other international media. They're, you know, going to pass a law in Russia labeling foreign media as foreign agents, you know, sort of in retaliation for what the U.S. has done with RT. But, you know, it's part of a general trend where autocratic administrations don't want freedom of speech, and they find, you know, foreign outlets to be a much more significant obstacle because they're not held, you know, to the same standards and not as easy to control as domestic media. And so Trump is basically just doing them a favor. He's saying, you know, this is who I side with. I side with dictators, and ideally he would like to function like one. And so I think that, you know, that's again where the net neutrality comes into play, because he doesn't need to take away the First Amendment. He doesn't need to take a stand against it even. He can just do it in a much more subtle, much more insidious way.
So what do you think, what should people be doing right now?
Contacting their representatives, I think, and, you know, getting educated about the issue, educating other people about the issue. I mean, there are a few things that make me slightly hopeful, you know, about the outcome of this, which is that I think a lot of corporations are going to be very upset by this. And unfortunately, in this country, they have more power than average citizens. You know, I've seen Netflix complaining. I also think there are citizens who are somewhat apolitical, and they're not really paying attention to the whole, you know, what does this mean for democracy? But if they can't get porn, if they can't get Netflix, if they can't get the things they're accustomed to getting on the internet, they're going to be upset, and they're going to protest this.
Right.
And I think that, you know, getting through to people, like, what this may look like is important. And, you know, and I hope that there's more detailed articles sort of spelling out the different outcomes, you know, because it's not completely possible to predict. Like, it could go a lot of different ways. But
yeah.
I think the more people know about that, the better.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about on a different topic, but still on the Trump topic, you had tweeted out that Trump seems terrified of the concept of sacrifice. I'm curious what you meant by that.
Yeah, I tweeted that, I think, originally about a month ago, you know, when he was attacking, you know, veterans again. I think he was attacking, you know, LaDavid's, Johnson's widow. Sorry, it's like he's done so many awful things, and I'm trying to rack my mind of what specifically I was writing about with that tweet. You know, and there's this pattern of him going after military veterans, and especially non-white military veterans. You know, you saw this with the Han family, with Johnson, and then, you know, even today with the Navajo code talkers. And I think that, you know, there are a variety of reasons for this. Some of this is Trump's racism, but I also think he's terrified by the idea of sacrifice. He's terrified at the idea that you could possibly value something other than yourself, you know, including your country. I think he's threatened by this idea. I think that, you know, what disgusted him about McCain getting captured isn't that McCain got captured, but that McCain was willing to risk his life, you know, for something higher than himself, for a more nobler goal. I think that concept is completely alien to him, and because of that, I think it frightens him. It makes him, you know, defensive, and it makes him very aggressive towards veterans. You know, I think his treatment of veterans is, you know, just abhorrent and should be covered a lot more. And also the way that, you know, Kelly responded to that situation was also really vile. Like, it's astounding to me that people who have served, you know, would treat other veterans and their families in this disrespect.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing is, and the weird thing to me is Kelly, Mattis, the rest of them all seem to be in lockstep. And a lot of veterans I know, they think because, you know, he has these big photo ops and he wraps himself in the language of patriotism that he's some great patriot.
Yeah, I mean, some do. You know, I've met plenty who don't, though. You know, a lot who are very disappointed and who are extremely offended. You know, they don't like to be used as props. They want their service to be respected, and they also just want to be treated better. They want better benefits. They want better, you know, mental health aid for things like PTSD. Like, there are all of these issues that veterans have been asking for a long time. And we have such a, you know, enormous class of people that have been in these ongoing wars, you know, these wars that have been going on for half of my life. And, you know, I saw my own generation go off to Afghanistan and Iraq and come back traumatized and never really, you know, get the kind of treatment and care that they should, you know, not really under any administration. And under Trump, I think it's even worse because he just doesn't have, you know, any respect for that. And, you know, I'm not a war proponent, but, you know, I do think that if you've done that, if you've sacrificed for your country, you should be, you know, given a level of respect, and certainly things like medical care and, you know, get your financial needs taken care of. And he just doesn't care. And it's very sad to me. Like, I remember at the campaign last year when he told somebody, you know, a veteran, that he'd always wanted a Purple Heart, which is just such a, you know, it's a ridiculous and an obscene thing to say. And the saddest thing is that guy gave it to him because he felt that Trump was a hero. He felt like Trump was going to look out for him. And I just looked at him and I was like, you know, he's not. He's going to screw you over. And it is extremely sad and painful to see that.
Now, I wonder what that guy, I would love to know what the guy thinks today.
Or
if he's still on the bandwagon. Because, you know, I look at how you finished it up. You said human beings have little inherent value to him. If he senses he will have to make a personal sacrifice, he will sacrifice the world instead.
Yeah, I think that that's true. And I know that when I wrote that, I was thinking of the conflict in North Korea and what was happening with Trump at the time, which is the same thing happening now, which is the Russia interference investigation bearing down on him, as well as other things that upset him, like his low popularity, you know, feuds within the administration, et cetera. I think he's always had this obsession with weapons, with destruction, with nuclear weapons. I know I've discussed this with you numerous times. If he's backed into a corner, he's going to lash out. I think the idea of not winning, you know, in the way that he defines it, is so beyond the pale for him that he would rather, you know, destroy the game than lose at it. And that means, you know, possibly annihilation of, you know, human life. I really, truly don't think he cares. I think he lacks the capacity for even the most basic forms of empathy. And that's a huge concern. You know, psychiatrists have also expressed concern over this aspect of his personality.
Yeah, it's scary, scary times. But again, we should be calling our representatives early often, especially on the net neutrality front, push back on this. Sarah, I appreciate your thoughts, your commentary, and all the work you do. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.